our guest and the official from the department has to see that mini lady.
This is the one who's only going to be. She had a meeting at 2 a.m. I mean, all at HDA.
Okay, yes. All right. No, he's going to find us on our way.
My name is Jan Roots. I'm also representing the department. Mr. Ngome Zulu from the department sends his apologies. He's engaged in, he must attend matters in Durban today.
Okay. You are welcome. Honourable members, I wish to welcome everybody in this meeting and a short day today. I think people will try their best when they make their presentations to try to be on time, but we are not encouraged that they should drop us. They must give everything. And the second issue is we were expecting three presentations today from the NETA, and then NFSC, and then NHPRC. But I wish to inform the members that we are going to have two, because the NHPRC have tendered an apology. But I've got the correspondence. I will read to the members later on. And based on that, I think we will be starting our presentation. But before that, let's get the apologies, if there are any apologies.
Besides the ones
that we have already received.
Good morning, members. I have two apologies. Mudalane is coming late, and Ms. Machoba says apologies, is not going to come at all. And also, NFSC is still on the way.
I think those apologies are accepted. Let's have the briefing by National Urban Reconstruction Agency. Over to you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Good morning to the Portfolio Committee members. Good morning to members from the Department of Human Settlements. Today with me is our Chief Financial Officer, Sandisa Sana, and our Chief of Operations, Wilwe Greta.
If you don't mind, just sit down. We know that you will sit down.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. My name is Morgan Fillet. I'm the new MD for NERSA. I've replaced Cedric De Beer. And this morning we'll be briefly talking to historic background in terms of NERSA. I think it's important to understand its performance in that context, and then to speak to the development performance for 2008-2009, and my colleague Sandisa will talk to the financial performance. And fourthly, I'd like to talk to the committee about what NERSA can do in addition, and to have a conversation about how we would try and achieve that. And lastly, to summarize the performance of NERSA. The company really is a partnership between the South African government and SEDF, which is the SOAS Foundation, and founded in 1995. I think as a presidential lead project, its performance has been exceptional. It has a unique capital structure that has both elements of concessional funding, grants, and commercial funding. And it has a diverse and robust board that's able to respond to the issues of risk and inherent risk in our market. And lastly, as a company, it's now become a specialist in construction finance and understanding the risks associated with construction. In terms of its mandate, over the years it's now become a well-established development finance institution, which means it's now become sensitized to the socioeconomic needs of our people in the country. And it's now pushing towards extending and expanding financing down market amidst high risk. We are focusing on options for financing housing and community-related infrastructure. And I think, again, Nurture has been quite robust in entering the area of integrated human settlements quite early on in its mandate. And we'll speak to its performance in that area. We're also promoting cooperation between public and private partnerships. And a lot of the money that we are mobilizing is actually coming from private sector. Demonstrating innovation through approaches and addressing areas of market failure. It's an area that we accurately addressing. And lastly, the mandate recognizes us as a risk manager of note. So in terms of our product, Chair, it's essentially bridging finance, which is short-term in nature. And we focus that through three programs, subsidy housing and service sites, affordable housing, and then infrastructure and community facilities. What makes us different from other players in the market is that we are able to intermediate both through indirect and direct approaches to contractors small and large. We have a technical assistance program and support that's able to manage risk. And we have capacity to support growing contractors. And lastly, we have expanded our geographical footprint to make sure that we can address needs at the local level. Chair, if we look at the performance of Nurture in the previous financial year, in terms of houses completed, we've approved almost 30,000 and we've completed almost 20,000, 18,000, the record shows as an accurate number. But I think what is important from a performance point of view is that there is a general growth in the performance of the organization. In terms of loans and project values in rand millions, you can see, although our relative investment in loans is small, but in relation to the actual project value that has been supported, it's phenomenal. In respect of houses completed and sites completed, we have in the financial year completed almost 18,000. In the previous year, it was 13,000. And I also mentioned earlier our role in infrastructure and community facilities. We had completed 25 of the 28 projects. In terms of number of houses and sites in approved loans, here in terms of affordable housing, subsidy housing, and service sites, almost 29,000 has been approved, and in the previous year, almost the same number. But again, when we look at infrastructure and community facilities, the number of projects that we had approved, 64, versus the previous year of 42. One of the things that I think Nurture has spent a lot of time and energy looking at, particularly from the point of view of outreach and managing risks, was to look at its investment in the southern or the South African context and make sure that we are now targeting projects in all the provinces. And those provinces where that we are blocked, we actually have physical presence in those provinces. And Madam Chair, we are looking in the next financial year to extend the presence to the rest of South Africa. In terms of the value of loans financed, we have currently financed 412 million versus the previous year of 262, which shows a fair growth. And this has been in the area of affordable housing, subsidy housing, and infrastructure and community facilities. In respect of the value of projects financed, and I think this is where significant growth has occurred. And it gives you an impression that with this small amount of money that Nurture has invested through bridging finance, It has facilitated larger investments in affordable housing, service, subsidized sites, and infrastructure and facilities. Chair, the point I want to demonstrate here with respect to empowerment, I think the track record has been very good in terms of NERSA being able to target black contractors. What is important in this picture is that we're now seeing some of the emerging contractors becoming established, meaning that they're able to attract repeat projects and begin to grow the business. I think an area that still needs improvement is female-owned enterprises, but I think, again, if you look at the past, at least we're starting to see some activity in that area. Again, Chair, it's not an area that we have control over, because really procurement and the approval of contracts happens at provincial and local government level, but we have an interest in financing contractors. Chair, I'm now going to ask my colleagues to talk to the financial performance, and then I will summarize.
Morning, Chair, and the members of the committee, colleagues from the department. I will briefly talk to our balance sheet as well as our income statement and the cash flow statement. This slide shows us that in total our non-current assets were 35 million, and this consists of the investments in construction projects, which is the loans that we grant to our contractors, and that figure represents a portion of the loan that is recoverable after 12 months, that is the non-current portion. We also have intangible assets of 514,000, and that relates to the system that we are currently developing in order to manage our project. And we have also about 857,000 that is spent towards property, plant, and equipment. NERSA really doesn't have big amount of fixed assets. We also reporting the current portion of our loans to contractors of 330 million, and that figure is shown after accounting for provision for losses. We also show a trade and other receivables of 1.2, as well as a cash and cash equivalent of 91 million. And it's worth noticing that this 91 million is almost half lower than the balance that we had in the previous year, which indicates that we used more of our own cash resources to finance our projects. This is the area where we're reporting our equity and liabilities. And in total, we have got accumulated reserve of 285 million. We also report SDF loan, which is repayable in 2016. And that figure is reported at fair value. We take into account the time value of that loan. You will notice that we have OSI specialized loan of zero. That OSI loan was now converted into a grant. You will notice in our income statement we have a big amount that relates to grant received from OSI. That relates then to the loan which in the previous years was reported as a loan. But with the agreement of OSI, it was now converted into a grant. There's also this 10 million, which I would propose that we look at it together with the 15 million that is shown under current liabilities. That is the 45 million In fact, it's 45 million that we will be paying to FMO effective from the 15th of November next month. In fact, we'll start paying the 15 million. That's why I'm reporting 15 million as a current portion. And in the following, after 6 months, we'll pay another portion, and we should settle the whole amount in 18 months. We are also reporting bank loans to finance projects. This is the money that we borrow from banks, especially the FNB, to finance our projects. That covers the balance sheet. And in our income statement, we had a good year, I must say. We managed to generate a total income from projects of from operations of 49 million, and the details of which is interest on money market investment. That is the surplus money that we invest whilst it's available to finance new loans. We also have interest and fees on project investment of 63 million, which is really an income from our core business. And we paid an interest of 17 million on the money that we now borrow from other sources. We're also reporting other income of 2.7 million, and that relates to 1.5 million that we are getting, or we got from FMO to finance operating expenses, as well as 1.1 million that relates to bad debts recovered. The admin expenses were about 36 million, and that is really lower than what we budgeted for, mainly because really we tried to manage the operating expenses. The project losses, we are reporting a total of 12.7 million, and 6.1 basically that's an increase in provisions, it's not a real loss, but the 6.6 it is a loss, the actual loss, the loans that are written off. I spoke about this, the loan that was converted into a grant, the total amount that was due is about 13 million. That then left us with a surplus for the period of about 16 million. Okay, the capacity report, this report really demonstrates the total capacity that NERSA has at the end of the financial year. It shows that we had a total capacity of 621 million, which is made up of the facilities that we have with FNB, the FDF loan, and the FMO loan. And at the end of the year, we had grants and approved loans and commitments of 437 million. And that then leaves us with a total capacity that is still available of 183 million. But what is worth noting is that even though that 183 million is there, it is ring-fenced to certain programs. It means we may not just use the money as we wish because it's dedicated to specific programs. The cash flow statement. The income that is generated from our operating activities is about 26 million, and the cash flow from investing activities the total outflow is 145 million, and that left us with about 28 million. And as at the end of the financial year, we had a cash book, a balance in our investment account of 90 million. And as I indicated, we started with 181 million and we're ending with 90 million because we had to use our own resources to finance projects. Okay, I think that covers the financial information.
Chair, in summary, while the performance of NERTA has been, I think, extensive in the previous financial year, my contention is that we can do more, but there are four important areas that we need to bring to the attention of this meeting. The first is the need to raise additional funding, and I think the emphasis here is at the right price. At the current level, NERTA as a national development finance institution is being treated by commercial banks in no different than the man on the street. So we are accessing funding at commercial rates, which makes it almost impossible to offer a benefit or a development benefit downstream. So I think we need to consider how we would facilitate the process around capital raising. The second is that we're seeing growth in the areas of infrastructure and community facilities, and the capital values of those projects are significant, and we would need to raise funding for those programs. And thirdly, we're looking at facilities now that are coming to an end. For example, our CFO talked about we need to pay FMO in three tranches of 15 billion starting November. So if we want to continue the pace of delivery, we need to make sure that those funds are replaced. Secondly, while we strengthened our position in six of the nine provinces, we need to consolidate the business development and the transactional flow through provincial offices. And we need to create relationships and links so that subsidy programs, infrastructure programs, and private programs by developers in the space of affordable gap housing can be supported through those regional offices. Thirdly, and we'll also ask our operations officer to comment on, relates to provincial and local government projects being halted or being blocked, either because there's technical problems associated with the projects or financial capacity within local government and provincial government to finance these projects on an ongoing basis. Now, we have financed a number of these projects which have been halted, and we need to look at mechanisms of how we can bridge finance these projects and bring them to conclusion. And we think if we can play a role there, we could save significant costs associated with escalation and reestablishment costs by contractors. So I think it's an area that we need to discuss. And lastly, I think we need to look at the technical assistance window to start to promote the concept of human settlements. I know NERTA has been doing a lot of work in infrastructure, but I think we need to do more so that projects can be sponsored and projects planning can be done in a way that it can be financed successfully. Chair, to conclude, I think in the previous financial year, the number of loans signed, 136 versus the previous year, 42% increase. The value of loans increased by 58%. The value of projects, significant increase. The houses in projects increased by 39%, and houses complete by 36%. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I don't think so to us the last page. But
Chair, I'm not sure whether members have this document.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's in this document.
Okay.
Okay. And I've also got CDs of this if anybody would like the copy of it.
Okay. I wish to welcome Mr. Laurent Weber, Mr. Jackie. Yeah. Mamupota, Mamupam, Panamufil, all of you are welcome. Mamuguanya, I love calling myself. Nandi Kakaza, I'm Nandi Kakaza, I want to do that, but I'm still a Kakaza. Thank you very much, CEO, for the presentation. I think now it's time for interaction, but you have got so many acronyms in your presentation, and I don't think we are all in line with your acronyms. But I think let's get the questions from the members. Honorable Steyn, Honorable Bonman, for now.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just start off, obviously, first by thanking the presenters. But I'm slightly taken aback. I mean, I went through this document last night, and I remarked to my colleagues here this morning that it's a relatively short document, so there's not much work ahead for us. And I must admit, there's a lot more detail in the presentation than there is in the annual report. And so my first question is why? Why was that information not in the annual report? Because unless somebody gave access to the presentation, they therefore lack some of the very important information that you've just given us, which doesn't appear in this document. So that is my first question, Chairperson. And then I'm going to just go in a structured way and perhaps just ask half the questions and open the second tranche just to give my colleagues some room as well. I'll just approve and complete it. There appears to be certainly over the last 3 years that you've shown, there's always this big difference between your approved houses and the completed houses. And if the presenter can just explain to me why. I obviously don't expect necessarily that we'd have a balance at the end of the financial year. But it just looks very, and the approved ones are increasing at a faster pace than the completed ones. So perhaps there's some explanation as to those figures. And similarly, the number of loans, houses in project and completed. And if I look at that, completed houses, number of houses, number of kids, there's a similar sort of disjuncture, which I'm sure is correct, but some explanation would go a long way towards making us understand that. Two more questions, Chair. Support to manage projects. I'd like to know, I've got an idea, but I'd like to know exactly what sort of support is being given to contractors. Presumably they are being charged a fee, and how competitive is their fee based with perhaps other consultants on the open market? And then just in terms of the intangible assets, it just says intangible assets. Perhaps if we could just say, often we have some notes regarding the financial information just to give further explanation. In this case, it's not there. So if I could have some indication of what that intangible asset is. And then if I can have a second round, I'd appreciate it.
I would like to just ask, in relation to, and you know, what you've just said now about banks charging you the same interest as the person on the street. I've been quite interested in your report, and I think previously when you've been here with the budget hearing, you've spoken about the downturn in the economy giving you an opportunity for development and growth, in your Now, and I also see that, and just to follow on from that housing thing, your houses approved and completed, you've got quite a substantial increase in the forthcoming year. Now, obviously, that depends on the finance that you're going to get in, and I just would like to have some indication of how confident you are in light of the fact of what you've just said now, because I would have thought that if you've got preferential treatment with your rate, that would have given you a better opportunity. So I'd like a bit of clarity on that. And then I would also like to ask you, you mentioned the, your financial man mentioned the 1.1 million bad debts. I'd like to know how you monitor and control repayment and how long that goes on before you pick it up, and whether, you know, the 1.1 million is all the bad debt, or how big that bad debt is, particularly in the current situation. And then just a simple question. I'm quite interested in the way you have gone into the provinces, and I'd like to know what criteria sort of determines where you go in the provinces. Like with the Northern Cape having nothing, I see the Free State, for example, has got a fairly large component. So just something on that, and then, have something on your staff complement that you have in nurture. I would be interested in that. Thank you.
Sure. Let me start with the information matter. I'm not sure whether members, there are two documents that you should have access to. One is just the annual review, and then it's the annual financial statements, which talk to the income statement, balance sheet, and there's more detail to that. So if there's an omission there, we need to make both those documents. Okay, so that could explain why, you know, you've seen part in the presentation and part in the document. But I remember that I do have copies of CDs here that had both pieces of the information. The question on houses completed versus houses approved. Now, we approve many, many applications for financing. And not all of the applications are completed 100%. Some of them are in various stages. So which means the overlap with in terms of counting the actual units would happen in the next financial year. But we do have problematic cases where certain conditions that we have put in the approval have not met. So we will always have, one, the construction lag, and also the suspensive condition lag in approved transactions not being finalized. The number of project loans completed, I think, again, when we look at the value of our projects, we focus on the bridging finance. So the peak cash flow for those is probably less than 40% of the total value of the project. So we're always going to be financing 40% in terms of bridging finance, and the total capital value being the balance. So then you're going to see a big gap. The idea we're trying to bring across is that we are facilitating a larger project value across all the programs that we're financing. The issue on support to manage projects, we do provide training to contractors, and the training relates to understanding the JVC, NEC agreements, understanding the claiming process, and the technicalities around that. We also work with intermediaries that do charge a fee for projects, and that relates to, it's not project management, but project administration. A lot of our contractors have difficulties in getting claims certified, sending it through, having it approved, and claiming the money. So support is provided there. What I can't give you is an accurate number in terms of fees, but it actually depends on the amount of work to be done to process a claim. And maybe, Viwe, you want to comment on that because you're quite close to projects. Intangible assets, Chair, I think our CFO would deal with. The question that's raised on interest rates, I think in the economy as it stands, there is the slowdown, particularly in the mortgage area, and particularly in areas of housing and construction. Now, the point that I'm raising is that for NERTA to provide a benefit to projects downstream and to finance contractors where we're exposed to high risk, we cannot be doing it purely on commercial terms. There are developers and contractors that can absorb pure commercial finance, but there are many others that we need to provide a benefit in terms of pricing. And this does not mean that we skew the market or over-subsidize the market. But then it means commercial funders need to come to the table and assist us in financing this need. Again, I'm making this on the premise that the state does not have all the resources to do this. So what I'm saying is in the review of policy, we must start looking at how private sector can become involved in assisting development finance institutions fund the social mandate. The other question that I can tackle relates to our presence in the provinces. Now, the selection of provinces and opening up of offices is not necessarily an arbitrary one. It's really one driven by the number of projects that are in the province. Because hopefully we want to cover the overhead costs of those offices through having live transactions. While I say that, I think we want to look at having a presence in the other provinces, and we will look at that as the volumes of projects increase. So, Lisa, do you want to take some of the other questions?
Okay. Thanks, Chair and committee members. I just want to add to the question that was raised on support. In the growth path of contractors, you find that contractors start where the owner of the construction company is everything. He is the accountant, he is the technical support, he is everything. And as contractors grow and take bigger projects, they require at particular stages to invest on technical support, people who can quantify variation orders that are instructed to make on site. They are able to make technical judgments. Similarly, they are required to attend to procurement and make sure that they schedule procurement as well as cash flows and all the cash flows that are related to tax claims and all that. And it becomes a critical moment at that stage for an owner to graduate beyond being everything in the company. And that's the stage where it becomes tender for that contractor because the day is still only 12 hours. So the type of enhancement that we do, we get into a negotiation with the contractor and understand where the gaps are. So if the contractor were to say, I've got a quantity surveyor on site, so we know that he has got the capacity to be supported on site on any variation that relates to technical support. Ours in the support of contractors is the recognition that 80% of the contractors that we support do not have security. They can't put a house down to say, if I default on this loan, you take my house. So once we approve the loan on the strength of the project, because we evaluate the project and see the project is strong, it can make profit, we then support the contractor all the way to realize that profit. So we would help the contractor schedule the procurement of material so that there's no wastage of material. We would support the contractor if given an instruction on site to do this variation and that variation, make sure that they quantify it appropriately. Because if they underquantify it, it affects the cash flows. And making sure that their claims, that claims are done timeously to feed into the cash flows. So that's the type of administration and technical support that we provide. Then they can pick and choose what they have. Hence, you hear when we talk about emerging and established. Because there are contractors who've got offices, backroom offices, that provide that support. So we're able to take security to them and give them loans. But they are a smaller group of contractors that we support. The bulk of our contractors are contractors that can deliver the asset, but do not have the strength of the balance sheet to be able to resource this type of thing. And you find that group, if we were to take the grading, CIDB grading, would be a group that sits between grade 2 up to 5. And perhaps at beyond that, contractors are starting to invest on their businesses. I think so. Was there another question that I needed to comment on? The other issue perhaps that I can add on is the establishment of offices across provinces. And it has been raised by the honorable members in this committee as well as the Department of Human Settlements. We are in a big drive. We were just interacting with the department about 3 weeks ago on the performance and the plans for the future. And we are not on a drive to market and talk to various provinces, because we can only market and talk to the stakeholders in various provinces. But contractors have to take products for us to be able to go to that province and support. We can report, which will be part of the report next year, because there are some projects now that we've signed in Northern Cape. We've got two projects, one housing and one infrastructure in the Northern Cape. And we are in a drive to build that business in order to establish infrastructure to support those contractors. Thank you very much.
I want to comment on two issues, the issue of intangible assets as well as the management of the loan book. The intangible asset of 514,000 that is reported relates to the development of the system that we will use to manage our project. Currently, we don't have a reliable project management system, and we took a decision that we definitely have to develop a system that will be tailor-made for the management of our projects. The next comment on the loan book management, we do have a very strict credit management policy, which informs us what to do, I mean how much to provide in percentage terms when a loan is 90 days old. That goes as well with the 180 days old debts and 365 days. And the management, senior management is informed on an ongoing basis, on a monthly basis, in terms of the total loan book and the amount that is overdue. And in some cases, then a decision is taken in terms of whether we take legal action against those contractors or not. The 1.1 million that I was referring to was now as a result of pursuing those legal actions, because the money was written off and then we had to recover this 1.1 million. Otherwise, we really have a very strong committee that monitors the loan book and decides what needs to be done if a debt gets out of hand. I think that covers the issue.
Yeah, Chair, maybe just two other comments. In terms of, there was a question on staff complement. At Mercer itself, we're sitting with about 41 people, head office. But I think you would recall that we do work with intermediaries that have their own staff complement, and they really do the footwork. The second point to add to is not necessarily on the budget, but to bring to the attention of the committee, provisioning. It is increasing, and it's increasing because of the projects I've highlighted earlier that are being halted at provincial and local government level. So there are plans, and we are discussing with the Department of Human Settlements how those projects get addressed so that the risk of that becoming a bad debt is managed appropriately.
Another opportunity given to members, a lot of cross-border and all of the community to be followed. You are welcome.
The presenter might have commented on this, but I'm going to ask this because I want to understand. Do you have a criteria for selection for contractors that you, or developers that you have to access funds? And to which extent or to what stage are you helping them? Is there any exit point?
I just want to check on your slide number 13, annual empowerment take-up. I'm very much worried about the very low percentage of female-owned contractors. I just want to know if there is there anything that you are doing to try and improve this low percentage of female contractors that are participating in nature, because there it reflects that you've got only 3% of female owned and 97% of male owned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Thank you.
I still need this acronym if you've used here. FMOSEGF. If you can assist us on that one. Honorable
thing. Thank you, Chairperson. Just a follow up on my earlier question, and the reason I'm sort of harping on this is because we've experienced that a large number of the block projects where emerging contractors were involved with, I believe primarily because of the sort of lack of skills, not particularly with building, although that's a big part if you look at the quality, but in terms of managing contracts, getting their claims in on time, that sort of thing. So I just want to go back to that. The explanation was relatively good, but particularly the gentleman over there, I think, was You referred to we assist them with the variation orders, etc. So my question goes back, is that capacity assistance within nurture or are you also using consultants? And it brings me back then to the cost, because presumably if you're making consultants available to them, I would like to believe that you don't put a margin on top of what the consultants ask you, and hence my earlier question about the competitiveness. So if that could just be further elaborated on. Then, Chairperson, I've got some questions on the finances here. Non-cash guaranteed capacity. What is that? Would that, again, relate back to that sort of skills assistance? Then, and it's in no particular order, mention was made finance for block projects. Now, I wonder if we could have an example, and they don't have to give it to us now, but if they could forward it to us. If we could have an example of projects where you have actually financed block projects. So that we could follow up, because in our interaction with the municipalities, they're always asking for additional funding, obviously, from Treasury and from the National Department. Now, when you say that you are funding them, are you funding the municipality, or are you then just giving the bridging finance to the contractor once they've basically been given the tender or they were successful with the tender? Then I want to address very briefly the additional funding. I think it's important, and my colleague referred to it, in terms of the cost of the money to these emerging contractors. If you get it at sort of commercial rates, then you can't give it much cheaper to the contractors downstream, and that is actually what we need. We need almost cheaper financing method for those types of contracts. Now, can't you make, there must be foundations, and some of these people that you interact with, I think, do give you cheaper finance. I'm not sure if it's yours or the other report that I've read where there was, in fact, no interest loans. May have been NHFC and not Nurture. But I mean, there's surely a possibility with the Bill Gates of the world, where one can try and access that sort of finance, so that you could then downstream provide a cheaper finance. I think that needs to be looked at, particularly with the infrastructure problems we have in our projects, and looking forward with sustainable human settlements, where we're looking at social amenities that need to be included or planned and built almost simultaneously. That is still not happening. And 5 years after the BNG was introduced by the minister, we certainly don't come across projects, perhaps other than one or two pilot projects, where this is being realized. Now, obviously, there's resources that is preventing this.
Yeah.
Chair, that's all. Thank you.
Okay. Chair, let me respond to the one on selection of contractors. Although we have an internal policy on the financing of contractors, I think we must bring to the attention of the committee, we have no control over the adjudication and awarding of contracts, which happens at the provincial and the local government level. However, that said, we do have a sensitivity to our policy to make sure that contractors with particular ownership status can access funding from NACHA. Okay, so there's a commitment there. So we cannot control that, and we don't have criteria on the selection of contractors. I think I've mentioned earlier, we are concerned about female-owned enterprises, particularly in the construction industry, and to the extent that we can facilitate bridging finance, we will. But we need projects to be awarded to them so that we can support and provide the finance. Chair, you mentioned FMO. FMO is the Dutch Development Funder, and FEDF is the Soros Economic Development Foundation. Block projects, I think, Louis, you can talk to that. And I'll talk about the funding for the future. I think this is probably the most pronounced debate that we need to have about if we want to make a big impact in infrastructure and in the other programs. And the short of the matter is, we have sources of commercial funding in the country, and we must develop a policy orientation that makes it without compulsion for commercial entities to provide funding at concessional rates. I'm not saying we need it free. At concessional rates that can be passed on to projects that have high development impact. Now, saying that means that NERTA is also talking to other donors, so that we are able to take commercial funding, blend it with either grant or funding that has low interest rates, and come up with a blended rate that now can support development activities. But I must say it's an extremely difficult task. And we can also comment, we're working with NHFC and other commercial institutions right now to leverage that. But it's something that I think we need some sort of policy support under which this can be directed. Colleagues, you want to take the other question?
Yeah. Can I add to the responses that have been made? Let me start by the criteria for approving contractors. Our main consideration when we approve contractors, the first one is that the contractor must have won a tender. And what we do is we look at that tender, we reprice it to check whether it was priced right and whether there's profit in there. And if it was priced right and it's we then call it viable, that contractor can make a percentage profit out of that. We then look at those weaknesses that may have been there, so that when we control the cash flows together with the contractors, we know those weaknesses that may need to be watched. So it may happen that the contractor has priced right for a particular stage and underpriced for it, but overall the project is viable. But it means that we have to support in managing the profit, because there's a stage that needs to be subsidized by the profits of another stage. Then the second thing, we assess the entity that is applying for the loan. Can they build, do they have capacity to support, do they have the right foreman on site, those types of things. Have they got a history in the construction industry. How have they done in the previous one? We'll still do the credit records and all. Credit records, we will do the necessary due diligence on that, but not necessarily to disqualify. There will be contractors that could be disqualified by that, but more to help them clean their record so that if they owe certain creditors, certain amounts, that can be settled from the profits of the current project, we help them improve their record. So that's one area of intervention. Coming to the fee that we charge, and I hope I would, I want to go carefully here so that I can respond to this. The fee that we charge is based on the value that we add to the contractor. So first of all, the contractor must agree that he or she needs that type of support. It's an area of weakness. For instance, at evaluation stage, we will look at the costing of the, let's say it's a housing project, and we look at the price per unit that that contractor is given. It could be that that award is done in January, 3 months before the end of the financial year. When we schedule the work, we then alert the contractor that we can start doing progress on this project. But at a particular stage, there has to be an agreement with the employer, that is the relevant department, that the price of the unit has to change to be current with the year at which we are building, because sometimes the projects straddle the years. And it's important that with the escalation of prices, the units are price-side. That's the type of advice we would give. If the terrain is not right, what are the types of variations that need to be done in foundation? What are the implications and costs? So it's added value to that project, and we price for that. What do we do in relation with consultants? In projects that have got consultants, let's say an infrastructure project, the client, that is the department, will appoint consultants, and those consultants are by and large representing the client, that is the department that has got a project. If they're building a school, those consultants are representing the department. We're not in a competitive territory with them. We reinforce the contractor to be able to secure his or her rights and be able to fulfill the project in the way it is required. And if there are no gaps that need support, then we back off, and you would see that that contractor automatically becomes categorized as an established contractor, because he or she can watch the goings-on on-site to be able to complete that project within the projected profit. Our important thing is that our security is in the completion of the project and that contractor realizing the profit, because if they don't, they collapse in the middle of the project, they don't repay our loan. So it's support, but with also a risk mitigation. So it is a positive type of support. I don't know whether or not I'm coming close to responding to your concern. Thank you.
Chair, there was a question on financing municipalities. Now, that's not part of our mandate. But as the landscape changes, and as we start looking at how do we finance integrated human settlements, I think it's an area that we're looking at very closely as Nurture. And we want to see to what extent we can work with municipalities to make sure finance is channeled into construction. So we're seeing it from the other end. And Chair, we'll try and provide some examples of block projects. I think we will need to go back and give some examples and come back to the committee. Do you want to raise the financial issues?
There was a question around non-cash guarantee capacity. In our capacity report, we also reflect on the arrangement that we have with FNB in terms of an overdraft facility, which is guaranteed by the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is referred to it as OPEC. because this is not really not coming in the form of cash, we refer to it then as the, this non-cash guaranteed capacity. We were also talking about the OSI. That OSI is this Open Society Institute of New York. I think that covers the questions of that.
Okay. Yeah, mine, Honorable Chair, is just a comment on the question by the Honorable Member concerning woman empowerment with the 3%. It's really a bit concern for me. It's more like, you know, when someone wants to have a contract for long distance, when you go to the financial institute to buy the truck, they said, no, bring the contract. When you go to the people to get a contract, they said, no, show us the truck. So I think something needs to be done to assist women in this regard. And specifically with the current situation, most of our women, they do have the right pedigree, they do have the right credentials, but I think the endless struggling that they are sitting with currently is they must have surety, they must have the right collateral, they must have a good and sound bank balance, which currently is the contrary. So something needs to be done as far as the policy is concerned, to assist women in this regard, and then we can say yes, truly, as a consortium or whatever body, we really assist in empowering women to so, you know, when one ever look at this 3%, I mean, 15 years from liberation, it's actually a disgrace. Thank you.
Yeah, I think
that one
is going
to be responded by the department. Honorable Fickline, to be followed by Honorable. This is the last round.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just a point of clarity. Since we are helping the beneficiaries through their subsidies, is there any savings that is made by beneficiaries to try and get a bigger house, or is just a normal size that you're building? Thank you.
Okay. Just one question, which I overlooked. The projected losses or written off was $6.6 million. However, I note in the previous year there was nothing. Now, this is quite a big jump from zero the previous year to this amount. Now, obviously, one takes into consideration the global situation, but and with the explanation that was given, where you scrutinize the projects and the context before you give the approval, it just makes it the question mark for me much bigger. So, if you could explain that.
Chair, I think in the previous year, there were more successful projects completed, and that's the basis upon which Nurture is able to recover its money in full. Now, in the period under discussion, I think we experienced problems in the Limpopo province, primarily, where there's been both, I think, contractor failure as well as project failure. And in those circumstances, the employer is not willing to pay out, and that's provincial government. So there is a process in place to try and recover those amounts. But I think to close the loop, we are saying that if we have a successful project, we can recover 100% of the funding. And if we look at where we are sitting at right now in terms of our 6 month review, although we have a high level of outstanding debt, the recoverability is quite high, because it means as projects move along and as we put pressure on local governments and provincial governments to make those payments or honor those payments to contractors, those monies will be recovered. But there are projects that have failed for which we have to write off. Chair, the question on subsidies and savings.
But perhaps can we have the names of those projects as well, or some information on those projects, so that, you know, we can follow up, because if the project has failed, then we're interested in...
Yes. Chair, we are happy to make that information available. On the question of subsidies and savings, I think it's an interesting point, and I think, yes, savings can assist to provide additional equity into a subsidy subsidized house, and certainly it can improve the quality and the size. So I think it's a much broader discussion around the value of saving in a project, in a subsidized project.
May I give the opportunity to the department if they want to breathe on this one?
Okay. If the department would like to breathe on this one, you are given an opportunity.
We didn't, Chair. We were listening to the responses. I think some of them are things we discussed continuously. And I thought maybe if the chair wanted me to explain from the department's perspective, policy perspective, the issue of empowerment, etc., I'm certain we've indicated what are the policy interventions we're putting in place. And I think those challenges that have been raised remain as such. Because from a financial perspective, NURTURE is the instrument for assisting. Of course, they've got to go through a evaluation and risk assessment and risk management process. From an empowerment training perspective, we utilize, and I think the committee will have an opportunity to interact with the National Home Builders Registration Council, which also has a program for training the technical side of construction, of contractors, emerging contractors, including the interventions required for main contractors. I think from a process perspective of allocation, provinces allocate using a criteria that also takes into account risk management, because they can, while they do the procurement process, they do the allocation, they also have to be certain that at least there is a likelihood that whoever is has either got sufficient support from all of these interventions that I've indicated to complete, to manage and complete the project in totality. So it's the interventions and the requirements are different depending on what their objective is. At the allocation stage, a province will do that. But the province know that they've got targets with regard to allocations to main contractors, which they have to seek to achieve. The 30%, for example, but they also have to do so within a context of ensuring that the projects that are allocated have a chance, a fair chance of being completed without problems. And therefore, in their criteria for allocating, they have got to look at the contractor, the status of the contractor, sufficient support from a finance perspective, which is NHBRC. And sufficient support from a training perspective, the extent of the grading, for example, of that institution. It's a bit complex than just that.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of this presentation. I wish to send a letter and his invitation and also the input from the
and also the input from the national department. But I think the issue of the spiraling costs is one of the concerns of the portfolio committee. I think the department has to look at that. We need a policy, really. We need to discuss about that thing and as soon as possible, because seemingly, that one is the one that is taking us back in the human settlement development. So, I wish to thank you very much, and you must make sure that you provide everything information that we have requested from you. You provide to the secretary. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. NHSC, you are welcome.
Thank you.
We received your apology. So your apology has been accepted by the portfolio committee that you are going to be a little bit later. So you are welcome.
Thank you.
Just sort yourself so that you can start, you can begin to make a presentation. I think we can now begin to get the presentation from NHSC. Over to you, CEO.
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair and honorable member of the Human Settlement Portfolio Committee. Mr. is the CFO of NHSC, the COO, and corporate and marketing executive, assistant executive. We welcome the opportunity to present the annual report. We have just extracted the salient features of the report, and that's what I'll be presenting. Firstly, Madam Chair, just to recap on terms of the mandate and the vision of the corporation, is really that of being a leader in provision of development finance. I think you also listening to the previous discussions and the issue of development finance is opposed to just normal finance. That is, I think, a challenge. I think we'll go through that with the presentation. But I think also our mission as an HFC is really to stimulate innovation in terms of the development of housing, affordable housing finance solutions. Now, to that extent, that speaks to the instruments themselves that are used in the market, but that also speaks to the total solution that will make housing finance affordable. And that is why we take that very seriously in terms of our approach to doing business. Our objectives are very threefold as a corporation. Firstly, we have the end user as the key stakeholder, and our role is to provide choice to the end user through the provision of housing finance. Some end users, based on their economic situation, they can build incrementally their houses, others can rent, and others can actually buy using mortgage instruments. So we want to provide that choice so that people have the opportunity to choose what is best based on their capacity. And secondly, is our objective is to encourage increased lending by financial institutions in this segment of the market. Madam Chair, we are persuaded as an HFC that, especially if one takes into consideration the backlog that is in the market, especially in the housing market or human settlement environment, we don't believe that government alone has the capacity to meet with that, to deal with that. And to that extent, our efforts, our endeavors, is to find ways in which we can facilitate increased lending by banks. I know they started the financial sector charter for the first five years, which has increased their role in this segment of the market, but that's not enough because the backlog still remains. And our endeavors is to make sure that we find ways in which we can actually bring them more stream, especially at scale, to the lower end of the market. But thirdly, our objective is to provide information in this segment of the market because there's a perception that the lower end of the market in totality is very risky. We're not denying that. But we believe with more information, that understanding can actually assist people in terms of the way they will price and deal with that segment of the market. And then briefly, we just highlighted some of the outcomes of our endeavors. But I would also like to hasten to say that one of our fifth endeavor here is we are about building cohesive and sustainable human settlements. So we looked at everything in across the value chain of human settlements, not just in terms of just your house being created. I know that we have not up to now accounted in terms of outcomes, in terms of jobs created due to our funding, but that's something that we began to request from everyone that we're lending to, so that we know that for every project that is under development, how many jobs are being created, because in most instances, it is local people who actually benefit from some of the projects that get done in every area where we're involved here. So I think in future, we will actually amplify our outcomes because they are broader than just money and the houses on the ground. Now, in our annual report, we did mention that we promised what we promised the year before, which was 2008, is that we will be lending greatly and also using our partners to be able to deliver. And I think as the results of 2009 bear witness to that, we have, in terms of number of projects that we have dealt with and financed, which is best, actually that amount is slightly less than about 511 million was dispersed in 2009. And also during last year, we did indicate that we will be experimenting on a retail home market, and we implemented that as of October last year. And it was operational, and I think I will give some evidence of that during the presentation. But also, we did indicate that we will be working with provinces to try and facilitate, especially projects taking place in especially those provinces that we have mentioned. And I can confirm that that has happened.
I think successes, especially in the Eastern Cape, are not at home as yet. I'm also mindful of the recent visit that the Human Settlement Committee had in the Eastern Cape. There are still some challenges there, but with the engagement is still continuing. In Limpopo, some developments have taken place, there's progress that has been made, and in the Western Cape, I've been here almost twice since April to launch some of the housing projects in the Western Cape. So I must just attest to the fact that progress has been made in that regard. Now, briefly, the history of the performance of the NHSC. I think I'd like to provide context to sometimes the question that we normally get is, yes, NHSC, we see these are the results, but how does it compare to the rest of the banks? So here we try to capture, simply to say, since inception, we had a capital of about 1 billion in total. In fact, that is on 400, and then later our shareholder added 500. And with that, to date, we've disbursed loans to the tune of about 4 billion since inception. Now, in terms of context, in our 14 years of existence as a corporation, we have been able to deliver approximately 7,000 units, housing units per annum, if one were average it across the 14 years. And compare that to the banks. The banks, any one of those four banks, on average, if you take their average, is about 11,700. And so, on a percentage terms, and remembering that banks, they've got bigger infrastructure, bigger balance sheet capacity, and on the basis of that, one can actually compare to say, what is the percentage contribution that we're making in the market vis-a-vis the other bigger financial institutions. But we've also just sketched out on a year-by-year basis, just to give context to the fact that we do, on a regular basis, benchmark ourselves against what's happening in the environment. So our delivery can be matched to what is taking place in the market. Some of the key highlights that are in the report, highest number of units, some we funded, some we co-funded with other institutions, and the disbursement, as it mentions in. But I think what I want to comment on is crowding in the private sector. We, based on our mission that we would like to stimulate innovative housing finance solutions in the market, we have been successful in pioneering a product which will be launched early in the new year. And this product is an instrument that is not a mortgage, but it will afford people in the low-income market to be able to acquire their houses, and it will protect them or shield them from the interest rate volatility. Now, if one were to take, based on our history in the past, 2 years, right now the rates are way below where they were some 18 months ago. Now, the person on the low end of the market does not have the ability to be shielded to that. And sometimes if it's going down, it's a benefit. But if it goes up, then they lose out everything they've got. But we've been able, through partnership with private sector, in this case, one of the biggest insurance institutions has come on board to take 50% in that initiative that we have set up, to be able to pioneer this instrument, and they being willing, actually, to fund part of it, just to make sure that the end user has got choice. Either you use the mortgage or you'll use this instrument. I think to us, it's a demonstration that our role of leveraging private sector is actually on the increase. In this case, we started taking 50% of the housing investment partnership, but one of the big insurance companies came and said, no, they wanted 50, and we diluted to 25. And so 75% of this initiative is owned by private sector and 25% by NHFC. But for us, it's a contribution to the market because it does provide options for the end users. And also, one of the key highlights Cape Town Community Housing Company, which is to be owned by the City of Cape Town, and has been a key delivery instrument, or one of the key delivery instruments, in especially in the city. We initially got engaged with the city and the province in actually promoting this vehicle over a number of years, to an extent that as of last year, the city came back and they wanted to sell this to some private players, which we were very grateful for, except that the price was too low, because we regarded that as dumping, because we have some assets that are still being owed to the NHSA. In view of that, we decided we'd rather perfect the ownership to 100% until such time that in 3 years' time we will put it back into the private market. But for now, we are really restructuring a Cape Town Community Housing Company and wanting to bring it to a position where it can be actually sellable to the private market, but it should be in a self-sustaining mode. And so that's really one of the key things that we've done in the year. I think it is in the report. And also with APSA, we've funded black estate agents. This has been a market which has been neglected for a while. In fact, on Monday, this coming Monday, the first 200 of those black estate agencies, there will be a launch to which the Deputy Minister of Human Settlement will be actually providing certificates in Gauteng. And so we're part of that because part of our role is really empowerment, especially with the people who are not involved in the mainstream of the market. And lastly, we organized towards the end of the year an urban development and housing social cohesion conference in partnership with the French Development Bank, to which we had a resounding feedback from especially the role players in the affordable housing market. Now, in a nutshell, the business of the NHSC is threefold. It's a project where we do both social and private rental projects, and we also do affordable housing for ownership purposes delivery. And the second component of our business is commercial. This is where we provide loans to people whose affordability level is below that of being able to buy their own houses. And in that regard, these people will be in the main building their homes over a number of years. That's incremental housing. And as I mentioned, that in the current year, we also set up the whole retail operation where we're offering retail loans to the end beneficiaries directly. And I will actually expound on that in terms of what experience has been in that regard. Briefly, Madam Chair, I'd just like to sketch the current economic environment and then how it affected us as an HFC. On the top of the graph, we see pre the crisis, which means one could say up to December 2007 or beginning of 2008. There were a number of unviable projects, and they could not access funding. And DFI had a role to play, which is where I just depicted the role where they had a potential role to play. And then on the high end, where highly viable projects, there you have commercial financiers like banks who were providing funding, and the risk sharing component, which has been the little circle that I have on top, that's where the banks play. If you can actually look at that diagram, you could see, even though they wanted risk sharing, but it was more on the high end of the market. And then came 2008 until maybe at the beginning of this year, which is the financial crisis and economic meltdown. It had some effects, but I think predominantly I just want to explain what that has done to the market, which is the current condition. You still have unviable projects, still not being able to access funding. But the role that you play as an HFC has actually gone bigger on the side of where access to funding has not been easy in the past. But not only that, we have spread through in terms of
our risk sharing, because now we want to bring the commercial and viable institutions more into the affordable housing market. So our risk sharing has actually grown as a result of that. And that's why what was a sector is getting to be almost like a dome, because now it's spreading the risk, which actually shows that the market has affected us, but it has made us to take even much more risk than we've done in the past. In terms of our portfolio as an HFC, one can see that the blue part, which is NHFC and other DFIs, it's almost like at the startup of things and up to a point where they are developed. And then when they are stable, the banks will take over from there. But most of what we do remains still on the higher risk end of the market. As you can see, commercial banks only start taking up things that are stable, that are running. And in fact, it's a good thing, because part of our role is to catalyze the market so that it becomes viable. Once it's viable, let the private sector actually run with it. And I think that also speaks to funding sources as well. Briefly, Madam Chair, just to explain what experience has been as far as the retail experience that we had in the past year. Firstly, the demand at end user level for retail has been increasing in volume. And the reason for that is the fact that as the market, due to market crunch and the banks withdrawing, more people still wanted a place where they could get financing. And so there's been an increased volume of end user applications coming through our door. And also people came to us because there was a high cost of financing from traditional funders. There was a requirement for people to, actually some banks made it clear until the last 3 months of this year that they wanted at least a minimum of about 10 to 15 or even 20% deposits for people to put down before they could actually finance them. And actually the potential high level of impairments due to the risk that was undertaken at the time. Some of the constraints in the market were, even though we wanted to provide loans to the end users, we realized that there was a high level of indebtedness in this market. One example I can make is we had a memorandum of understanding with Impala Platinum to provide loans for their blue-collar workers, miners. And out of a total of about 9,000, the approval rate would be about 300, simply because when one does analyze the information that's given to us, you realize that there's a lot of high level of indebtedness at those levels. And as well, the issue of affordability levels is very low, and therefore that's why there's still a need to see what other instruments can be used to assist people. And in some instances, at retail level, we had people knocking on the door saying they want loans, but their income was decreasing, not just because of inflation, but some of those in the meantime lost their jobs during the period when they were still searching for ways in which they could address their housing finance needs. And so these are some of the experiences that we had through our retail office. Now, just to conclude on the end user side, we noted that in the market, especially including it in the current, before it changes, is that commercial banks, they've got a short term view, there's still a tighter lending criteria, and at the moment, there's still less credit being granted. I know, especially some two or three banks have announced that they've relaxed their lending criteria, but that's still a work in process. From the NHFC side, we designed an accommodative criteria, but bearing in mind that our lending must not necessarily actually be such that it increases our impairment without control over that. But otherwise, part of our role is that of assisting end users, especially those in distress, and also to
based on that understanding, to deal with them in a way that is dignified. But on the other side, we could see the arrows are going in different ways. But this has been the experience of the end users in the segment of the market. Madam Chair, I'd also like to highlight the fact that, as an HFC, we came to a conclusion that strategic partnerships are one way in which you can extend our reach and actually expand even our impact in the marketplace. I spoke about innovative offering, but the second one is through our partnership, we have increased involvement in financing, especially inner city regeneration. And through that, we facilitated the formation of a company called Trust for Urban Housing Finance. And initially, the company was set up and operating mainly in Gauteng. But right now, for the similar business model, is being exported to KZN, Eastern Cape. I'm told that we have scanned the Western Cape, and it looks like maybe in terms of affordability, it's not there yet. But this is a model that has been expanded to other provinces as well, where dilapidated inner city buildings and some industrial places are being converted for residential purposes, just to provide people with affordable rental housing, especially close to their place of work. And we believe that it is such initiatives that actually increase the extent of the impact that we're having. And lastly, I spoke about CCCHC, which is an example of a public-to-public partnership, especially working with cities and provinces to increase and expand delivery. And may I, Madam Chair, through your permission, just to let the CFO just to talk through the finances.
Okay. Looking at the financials, I think the key events, reading from what the CEO was saying, that impacted the financials. For the first time, we had another subsidiary, CTCHC, so their results are consolidated into our accounts. The second key event, the impact is also HIP, Housing Investment Partners, our 25% share, which will come through the income statement where we show the share of the loss. And the third key was also the revaluation of our investment property. The result of that it comes through in the income statement. Our balance sheet, the key component is the loan assets, and it shows the growth from 2008 to 2009. And on the other side, it shows the growth on our capital reserves from just over 2.04 billion to 2.1. Included in non-current liabilities, energy itself does not have liabilities currently. That is mainly the funds under management and a portion of the subsidiary liabilities that's included in there. The next slide just shows the trend of our profit before tax. Sorry about that. The next slide is a summary income statement. We were pretty much on par for the lending income as a result of the disbursements for the year. The main driver of the lending income is the disbursement. Impairments have increased somewhat from the 12 to the 17. There is a slight dealing with explanations further. We have managed to reduce or contain our operating expenses below that of the budget for the year. Investment sundry income is mainly our investment portfolio, together with sundry income as well. So the bottom line, the profit before tax is 82% above budget, and profit for the period 107 versus 57 million for, in the budget. The next slide basically just give a trend of our profit before tax from 05 to 09. The significant jump in 09 is the level of disbursements is one aspect. The other aspect that contributed to the jump is also the higher interest rates that you know was evident for most of the year in that period. And then also the revaluation of the investment property. This slide basically just explains some of the variances. As said, our profit before tax 2% above budget. Operating income was decreased somewhat by the level of impairment. Included in there was the book previously that we held. It was sold and we incurred, or it was written off subsequently. Operating expenses, mainly, 19% below budget, under expenditure and employee, marketing, travel, office, and computer costs. And as mentioned, investments, higher than budgeted interest rates for most part of the year, as well as the investment property that came in there.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to present the rest of the slides on the presentation. Looking at the NHSC provincial footprint, the NHSC as a national organization endeavors to extend its reach to all provinces across the country in its implementation of its various initiatives and programs. However, we have a bigger footprint in some provinces and less in others. For instance, as depicted on the map that you see, Gauteng, we have the biggest footprint in Gauteng with 48.4%, followed by Western Cape with 28.0%, and then KwaZulu-Natal is third with 19.7%, followed by Eastern Cape with 2.5%, and the other provinces. We have various projects that we have funded. Looking at the first slide on the left, top left, we have Guildford Court. This is a project which is situated in Berea in Johannesburg. It's one of the TAP's inner city regeneration project. I'm not sure if it was mentioned earlier, the TAP has now commercialized. It's now a commercial entity. And the NHSC has planned for, to own 15% in the entity. The next one is, bottom left, is Hillary Umkumban. This project is situated in KZN, and it's an example of a Job Summit project. The third one on the right, top right, that is Morgan's Village. This project is situated in Cape Town. It's one of the projects of the Cape Town Community Housing Company. What you see depicted there on the slide is a picture of phase one of Morgan's Village. Phase one and two have been completed, and construction has just recently commenced in phase three. In fact, about a week ago, a sword turning event was held in Cape Town to launch this project. Bottom right, the NHSC Retail Impala in Rustenburg. This is an example of our employer-based partnership project, where the NHSC is providing finance for those employees of Impala who would want to buy a house. About 20 loans have already been disbursed since we went live with the retail, which was on the 20th of October last year, and 2,238 loans have been approved. Moving on to the next slide, that's corporate governance. As the NHSC, we conform to the requirements of King II report and all protocol on corporate governance. The corporation had a reporting irregularity for the first time since its inception in purchasing the shares in the city CHC, but this was subsequently approved by the minister. There's more details about this in the report. We've had an unqualified audit report for the past 14 years. Since existence, we remain a Schedule 3A entity. And before I start talking about the committees, on the right, we have a picture here of the board members, the current board members of the NHSC. But in addition to this, there are other members who've recently joined, and they are Ms. Tekane Ramarumo, Mr. Johan Kutsia and a lady by the name of Anthea Houston. We have all necessary committees in place in terms of the PSMA, and the diagram denoted on the following slide. The government structure, we've got the board of directors, board committees. There are about three board committees. The executive committee, which comprises of the CEO and his executive managers. The management committees, we have two, and operational functions. Moving on to the next slide, which is the concluding slide. I'd like to mention that as the NHSC, we'll continue to play our part in the upliftment of communities through the provision of finance for sustainable human settlements by doing the following: providing choice to the provision of housing finance. The CEO spoke about that earlier. Rental, for example, incremental, if you want to improve on your house or if you want to buy. Encouraging increased lending by financial institutions to the low end of the market by establishing partnerships, you know, with banks and other players in the market. And the third one is providing timely research and market analysis to empower the low-income households to enable them to make informed decisions, including consumer education. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for your time. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's the end of the presentation.
Okay. Honorable Makurua, Honorable O'Brien, Honorable Fitland, Honorable Spain, lastly, Honorable Bome. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. A very interesting observation is that during the budget vote, the Rural Housing Loan Fund reduced their reimbursement in the province. And if you look to the reimbursement of NHFC, it looks like there's a parallel. It's almost exactly the same. And I would really like to know what is the response to that, knowing that Eastern Cape is a very rural province. The RHLF in Northern Cape indicated that there's actually 0%, and the argument was that now there are people from Northern Cape staying in Mpumalanga, wherever, so they reason that they're helping people to via that sort of reason. The hive of activities is in Gauteng. In terms of the black training agent, what is lacking in the report is also the origin of these training agents. I don't want to make an assumption that it's from Gauteng, but one also would like to see that there is some sort of territorial training as far as other provinces on these black training agents is concerned, so that one can have it throughout the country.
I don't like that you are behind us. You rather join this side, please. I don't like this. It's in the narrative. If you are excluded in this, you're also part of this meeting. You're also part of this meeting. Honorable Mugwani.
Thank you, Chairperson. Pam Mugwanya is the name. Chairperson, I have been partly covered by the previous speaker, but I would. It's curious for me, coming from a rural area, to really find out how conversant are the local banks particularly in our rural towns, with these opportunities, because from what we are hearing, you know, the building industry is not as impenetrable as it is made to appear, both by private private owner, property owners, as well as contractors themselves. I want to find out how you manage to put your footprint in the in this area, or if these opportunities are available only to highly sophisticated cities, where you know there is you know ICT and things like that, but not on the ordinary rural banks, because stuff in these banks, I'm almost sure I don't know about these.
Honorable
Chairman. Thank you, Chairman. Mine is just three questions. The first one is, I just want to find out, we support a policy of rent to buy, especially we've got a backlog of backyarders that are looking for accommodation. The second one is, I would say this is a very good initiative to deliver houses for rental and ownership, but the number achieved of 11,939 units is not enough. Is this a national figure or a provincial number of people benefited from NHFC? The second one is, my understanding is that the city of Cape Town decided to sell its 50% shareholding, which you have bought, and the NHF has been able to deliver over 3,500 houses. Who are the beneficiaries of these 3,500? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would just like to, let me see what hasn't been on. I want to refer to the reportable irregularity on page 42-43 of your report, and you have mentioned that. And it will be taken care of, but I think maybe this is more to the department than to to the FCH. And that is how somebody can actually approve something which is illegal. If you're looking for it, in the report 43 right at the bottom of the page. Without prior approval of the executive authority as required in terms of the PFM Act. And I wonder what we are doing to avoid things like that in the future. I think that's the one thing. And then perhaps a really stupid question I want to ask, and that is, I would like to understand in your statements the difference between group and company. I'm not clear about that. I should have asked it in the beginning, then I might have understood, but you know, I didn't want to interfere with the flow there. And then also, I just want to refer to your partnership with the Kuyasa Fund, I think that's the way you pronounce it, to provide access to housing to some of the most disadvantaged homeowners. And I think my question here, and there's a mention of a plus minus 1,600 rand. That there must be some repayable section of that. And I'm just wondering how people on that sum of money, of earnings, you know, repay and pay for school fees and their food and all of that. I just would like to understand that. My other question has been, I just meant to refer also to page 30 in your report on the board's meeting. And I just want to refer to your audit and risk adopted causa, 6 out of 9 meetings. I'm just wondering how your meetings sort of go on with less people, because there's quite a small number of people in these meetings. And then I also see Mr. Luba on the board meetings. He's only attended 3 of the 5. And also, yes, and then Mr. Luba also 4 out of 6 on your HREO. And then if I could ask the same question we had of the previous, your bad debts, how are those being managed and monitored, and the size of those, and your recoverable rate on that. I've got a question here. Bad debt, small, not a problem. I'm not terribly sure what I'm asking you about that. Okay. All right, just get out of here. Anyway, it's a question. Thank you, Chairperson. Another thing?
Thank you, Chair. The question is probably why is it so small? First of all, again, let me thank the presenter. I think my colleagues are at a slight disadvantage. We got these reports, I think, Tuesday or Wednesday. We've had a full sort of week, and then we, due to our own planning, I think we got that before us today. So I certainly didn't have time to go through this entire report. But nevertheless, I do have a number of questions. The first one would be, and I recall something, and I'm not sure in whether it was in the President's State of the Nation address or something, but there was specific reference made to NHFC transforming into a bank, if I'm not incorrect. But there's nothing that I can pick up in the presentation or in the report that relates to that. So if I could have some information as to what the status is, because the idea was that it would certainly enhance the access to finance by doing that. Then mention was made, and perhaps it's because of our visit last week, but very specifically about technical assistance to the Eastern Cape, and I think it's on page 19 of this document, yes. Eastern Cape and Limpopo and Western Cape in 2009. Now, from our visit there last week, I can't say that I've seen this technical assistance from NHFC. So I'd like to some information regarding that. I also have a question regarding the acquisition of CTCHC. Firstly, from the presentation, I got the impression that it was done primarily to safeguard the initial 50% investment. But my information and recollection over the last couple of years about CTCHC is that they didn't have a good reputation in terms of the product that they delivered. And it may be, I don't know, but it may be one of the reasons why the City of Cape Town wanted to get rid of it. So, was a proper risk assessment done? Because it's not the core mandate of NHFC to acquire or to be a developing agent, quite honestly. So I'd also like more information regarding that, particularly in light of the fact that I think at the time that it was acquired, it showed a loss of some 2 million rand, if I am not mistaken, and there was something on page 17 in this document regarding that. Then, Chairperson, the mention was made about a shareholder compact, I think with government, as the main shareholder, which will only commence now in in this particular financial year, not the one for this report. But some information, what exactly is that compact about? A question. Reference was made to, in some cases, beneficiaries, and in some cases, end users. Just some clarity. The end user, the entity that enters and gets the loan, and the beneficiary, the person that eventually gets the house, I'm not too sure what that is there. Just two last questions, Chairperson. The South African Housing Trust, which was I don't know if I should use the word closed down or whether they were went into liquidation or something in 2003. Their advance book was worth 10 million rand last year, or rather this year, from 20 million in 2008, from the previous year. So it's, again, an explanation for that. And Tbilisi, there were advances made to Tbilisi, which is shown in the statements here, of 113 million. I recollect from the National Department's report that they, perhaps very naughtily, I think, paid on behalf of Tbilisi 100 million towards NHFC. So there's a discrepancy. There was a 3 million written off. Or what is the story there? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, on the question of rural footprint, the way NHFC expands its impact, especially to remote areas, would be through its retail intermediaries. For instance, in the Northern Cape, predominantly there will be incremental housing would be the main instrument that would be used to be used to provide for the needs, the housing needs of the people in the area. And so when a retail intermediary do an application for a facility, this is one of the key questions, the part of the criteria that we use to say, where are your outreach strategies going to lead to? And to that extent, and that's why we were able to produce a map like that, because that becomes part of our step to be able to track in terms of where is this impact being made. In areas like Limpopo, some of those are project developments. We are involved even in the Eastern Cape. There would be projects that NHFC is initiating either in partnership with the province or with the local authority. In terms of the remote parts of that, of some of the provinces, the biggest instrument that we use is incremental, and therefore it would be on the basis of the retail intermediaries that we use to be able to provide housing finance in those areas. Now, I think the question was, how does, is that knowledge common? And I think that that's something that we're working on, because would like that people should be able to know that they can access finance, especially from intermediaries that are supported by the NHFC. So that's still a work in progress in terms of, is it common knowledge? And especially in areas where the banks and it actually do not have any infrastructure in place. And then the other question which I'd like to answer is, oh, the agents, yeah, the training agents. Let me say we work with the Association of State Agency Boards, which I think is a national body, more than provincial. And it is in partnership with them that we're doing this. I think the fact that training is taking, maybe taking place in Gauteng, but the company that actually provides training is on a national basis. And so I think through the agency board, we're able to make sure that it's not just limited to housing in terms of who actually get access to that kind of training. I may as well say, this is 400. The first 200 is done. Now we'll be doing the next 200. And I think one will also validate the fact that that 200 comes actually across the various provinces instead of just in housing. I think the issue of footprint to the banks, rent to buy. I think the question was on the rent to buy. Yes, we do rent to buy as one of the options. It's rent, pure rent, and mortgage, and actually rent to buy. In terms of numbers, we said 11,000, whatever the number that we gave, that is the deliverable for the year, and that's national. I think it is acknowledged. I think we do agree that the number is, it looks, especially if one were to match it with what's the potential in that target market, not very big. But that's why, as part of my presentation earlier, I benchmark this with what the banks are doing. On average, one of the four, between the four major banks, they deliver about 11,000 per annum, and that's all they can do themselves, just one single bank per annum. And so to that extent, even if you look at this total in the context of in this market that we're servicing, then you realize that it is actually not very far from what they are able to deliver. I think on the CTCHC, I'll ask Edwin to comment.
Yeah, there were a number of questions on CTCHC, so perhaps we should handle those all together. In 1998, when NHSC... In 1998, when NHSC, or HIVF at the time, went into that partnership, the idea was that they would work with the local councils and it would be a replicable operation. Now, in a matter of a couple of years, they delivered something like 3,000 units, which is probably the highest that any social housing institution had delivered over that time. And yes, there certainly were problems with the quality of the buildings going forward, but there was also a certain amount of problem with the way in which it was set up to be a savings-based operation, where the credit controls weren't done, people saved for 6 months and then went on to a waiting list. But if we move forward, the province has given has provided funding for the renovation of those units. And in those 10 years, the company has provided, in the majority of which are subsidized units, up to about 4,000 units in the 10 years, which is a fairly substantial offering from any company. Besides the fact that when it was put out to tender, although obviously we would like to see a turnaround in the company, it was also that the first time they went to tender, we didn't try and get involved at all, and the tenderer couldn't provide the funding that he had offered. The second time, with a very small offering, the person who was going to be the CC that was going to be looking at buying had absolutely no experience in housing, not low income, not high, it was absolutely a startup. So it wasn't going to be a worthwhile partner. You know, it would have been great if there was a viable partner. So that was why that decision was made. The confusion on the buying of the shares and the irregularity was that the 50% of the shares cost $5 million, which was below our materiality of $13 million, you know, the approved materiality. And that was the confusion. As soon as we realized that there was a problem, we put the right applications in and the minister approved it. So we were humbled by that, because it's not something that NHSC would generally do. We try to conform in every way to PFMA. So, but there's no way that we can talk ourselves out of it. That happened, but we did everything we could to react properly, and I think the department has, that's all been settled, and by the time our annual report was drafted, that had been finalized. As I can't explain, the one question about this is not our core business. No, it's not, but it was a way of delivering at scale at the time, and to that extent has been fairly successful, and at the moment they're looking to turning around into a profit in the next financial year. But also NHSC will only be in ownership of the shares for 3 years in terms of our permission from the department, and then we will look to selling that and to be able to recover some of our costs. But in the meantime, they've just started a project of 682 units, so the delivery is fairly good. And so no, this is not our normal, operating model, so we're not going to be in it on an indefinite basis. I think I've answered all the questions that were asked on CBCSC.
Can you share something about this, the progress on the transformation of NHSC? What work have you done, and is there any work that you have submitted to the department? Because I think we have to consult in whatever with the department.
Madam Chair, talking about the transformation of the NHFC, the NHFC has transformed, especially from the business model that it pursued in the beginning. Initially, the NHFC was purely a wholesale lender, and it was lending through intermediaries for ownership, for incremental housing, and also for rental funding purposes. Now, when we undertook that mandate of transforming the corporation initially then changed to firstly be a facilitator of housing development, of affordable housing across the housing spectrum. In that regard, our programs were more proactive towards making sure that delivery is taking place in the affordable housing market. On one hand, we're using retail intermediaries, but on the other hand, we're using the increased participation of banks in this segment of the market. Now, the mandate of us becoming a bank actually implied that we would be a mechanism or a vehicle through which human settlements may be able to have funding generated so that it can be supplied for housing purposes, be it directly or through some of the housing institutions. That still remains an assignment that NHFC actually has transformed into being. As a result, we have gone out to look for additional funding so that we can make funding to be available in the housing process. Now, the word bank, in fact, it was at the time debated, especially the register of banks, to say if you don't take deposits from the people in the street, the public, then you're not a bank. And the intention was never for us to take deposits from the public. The intention was that we can raise money in the capital markets, we can raise money in the institutional investor market, but make that money actually available in the housing process, which we have begun to do. We are a rated institution in terms of credit rating, and on the basis of that, multilateral institutions do come and do due diligence of the NHFC and are willing to actually lend money. But also, you know, taking into the discussion that took place earlier with NHFC, if it's multilateral institutions, that money is affordable. But with local financial institutions, money would be on the same terms as is taking place. Therefore, it should not be, I think, a good base to support affordable housing with. And so what, Madam Chair, I can confirm with the committee is that that role of us facilitating greater funding into the housing process, it is in place. In fact, we've got two multilaterals who have actually made commitments to want to assist us, especially to fund some of the projects and make money available so that there could be greater money available in the housing process for the affordable housing market. And so if one asks the question, is that the role of being a bank? I think it is a type of a bank. It's just that sometimes when we think of a bank, we may be thinking of the various other instruments that may be used to the benefit of the end user. At the end of the day, our role is if we can raise sufficient funding for the affordable housing market and let it benefit the end user, then we would have achieved our mandate. And so the status at which we're at right now is we're operating on the basis that not only are we using the funds that we have, but we try to increase those funds, not just for ourselves, but for anyone who may need funding within the affordable housing market spectrum, and we make that available to them. So that's really what one can comment in terms of being a bank. So it's not really purely like taking deposits. And even the restructuring of the corporation has been to that extent that it facilitates us being able to raise additional money for the housing, for the affordable housing market.
Yeah.
maybe I can respond to the question about the group versus the company. The company refers to the NHSC company alone. The group refers to the group structure, and part of the group structure would be the NHSC, and as we've mentioned, CCCHC, that would have been consolidated. The other company, we have a cell captive as well, and then two dormant companies, Gateway. So they all make up the group numbers.
Madam Chair, let me go back to the issue of irregularity just to conclude on that. The issue was materiality. As we said, the threshold was 13 and this was 5, and that's why we began by undertaking the process. But we've put in place processes and governance structures, including internal and external auditors, that in future, you know, such things, there will be no repeat of that. And I can assure the committee on that one. In terms of governance, also about board participation, with every committee of the board, even the board itself, there's a quorum status. And on the basis of a quorum being met, based on the terms of reference of that body, then the meeting will actually continue. But one cannot refute the fact that some of the absentia here, a meeting will not take place, any one of those governance meetings take place if there's no quorum, because we have to comply to the terms of reference of those governance structures. But also, even with in consultation with the department, there was a sense that we needed to beef up the capacity of the board, which has happened. Up to now, we've added 3 new members on the board, which has actually enriched the board subcommittees to a level where in some committees we have 4 non-executive board members as a representative for that committee. In case one of them is not there, at least we've got 3 non-executive. But I think we're guided across all our governance structures by the terms of reference and making sure that we do correlate on the basis of the terms of reference.
Maybe I missed the response on the management or monitoring of your bad debt.
Oh.
And also the issue of the compact. Can just come up.
Okay. Just let me address the issue of Guyasa then the bad debt.
Yes,
yes, Guyasa is based in Cape Town, but they operate in Cape Town, George, and PE. And they do provide funding, but they're very small loans to really the lower end of the market. But quite a few people have come back for second and third loans. The leakage is very well managed because they have people who go out to make sure that things are happening, but most of the work is done locally. So although they are very small loans and there's little affordability, it's quite amazing to see how people have improved in their homes by sweat equity. And if the committee would like the visit to Kavicha sometimes, we'd be happy to organize that with them, because it actually is amazing to see what can happen when people have the will to do something for themselves. And so, yes, it's small, and we're very happy to be part of that partnership, because it's really the bottom end of the market. And many of the people who have had burns, they were talking about women earlier, the majority of their customers are women. Many times, older women who are looking after families have lost parents. So it's really a very interesting social lender.
HTSHCTH credibility. There was a question around it, and also there was also another question on the issue of provision of finance to the disadvantaged community.
Chair, at the best,
yeah, we're going through the
okay.
Maybe on the bad debts. Now, bad debts is a percentage of our advances. It's just over 5%. The trends are included in the financial report. We have an approved credit policy in the credit department that manages the whole chain from approval to collection, litigation, and turnaround. Obviously, at various stages, various processes would kick in. We have seen that from the past, most of the experiences were with the social housing institution,
And because as time, you know, goes by, we most of them, you know, at some point we had to write off. So our bad debt ratio has improved, you know, within recent times. Maybe I can deal with the question of, there was a question about SAHT and the decrease from 20 to 10 million. One of the books was the book from Mpumalanga Housing. It is included in the notes to the financials, and the book was settled in full. And even in this financial year, the second book was settled as well. So it will decrease to almost, in fact, it will become null within the current financial year. And then, Cheryl, let's come back.
Come back. At the time, in fact, we were 3As, and at one stage there wasn't a requirement for a social compact, but we were moving to a 3B. You'll notice that we're now again staying as 3A, but we have in fact negotiated a shareholders compact with the department, and that has been done for all institutions. So, and that covers the interactions of the governance and the interaction with the department, and it's fairly detailed. So it's really a modus operandi between the two institutions. And all housing institutions are having one with the department. It's required for the 3B, but even for 3A, it's been done.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question, Chair?
No, I'm not.
I want your question.
The members, I
must
ask. Reminding you of the questions that are asked by the members. The last one, I think, is about the disadvantaged communities. Provision of finances to the girls. There was a question on that one.
That was the one she did.
Okay. Another one. Okay. There's two relatively, hopefully, short and simple questions or answers to. One was the distinction between beneficiaries and end users.
Yes.
The other one was the technical assistance or lack thereof in the Eastern Cape. And then I also asked something about Tbilisi and the 130 million versus 100 million that was paid off.
Madam Chair, we can provide some information on the extent of the progress with the technical assistance in the Eastern Cape. I know you saw your pictures as you're walking down Eastern Cape. And some of the things are still in progress state as we speak. But there's been an involvement of our team. In fact, to an extent that some have spent some days in the Eastern Cape, and also the head of housing in the Eastern Cape coming to NHFC. So some things are still work in progress, but I can provide additional information on that. End users and beneficiaries, my apologies for the beneficiaries are the people who, when we account for how many people actually benefited from the funding that we made. The end user is the recipient of the fund. So there might be one end user, but maybe four people who are going to be beneficiaries. That's the distinction between the two. And to Belisha, yes, we got repayment of 100 million. And whether or not have you written off the outstanding balance, the answer is no. And we're still engaging with the department in that regard. Because it remains financial transaction, and it remains like that. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe just to mention the facility, although it was issued 3 years ago, there was a moratorium on the repayment. So it's only due now in September was the term. So it would have been on our books as of year end, the 400 million, and it was received subsequent to the year end, the 100 million. There is a portion of the interest that remains outstanding, and it is, you know, reflected in our current account.
I think I can give the department if they want to say something, because I've seen this around.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Bowman, I'm not going to leave me alone. Yes, I think the question was with reference to the reportable non-compliance. Sale of shares, what the department would have. I need to explain, express that we dealt with the matter with the NHFC. we expressed our disquiet with the non strict non compliance. They explained the reasons for that. We considered them reasonable. We, because at the time we're evaluating the feasibility, the business and the viability of the proposals that we're considering, that they were that they had been proposing with regard to the acquisition. I think in the end we took a view that it is reasonable, prudent, it is normal business for investors to look after their investment by first looking at how they can resuscitate the viability of the entity at hand. It also coincides with our own strategy with regard to the social housing institutions, of which the CTC is, of rehabilitating those that are capable of doing so by changing it, by ensuring that you fix the governance, some of the causes of the situation with those institutions. I think one of the key things with the Cape Town thing and some of the others that may not necessarily have had any direct transactions with ourselves is that we our strategy says stop being a regional or a geographically defined institution, for social housing in the country is in demand. And in that regard, I think that the fact that they were now, first you accepted that Cape Town would take a view because of their core business, that it is not in their interest to do so, that is fine. NHFC had invested, they would lose if nothing is done to rehabilitate the institution. If they have done a viability assessment that says they can rehabilitate it within the provisions of the current social housing program, we then felt it was necessary, would both benefit by protecting the investment of the institution, rehabilitate the institution, and look at upscaling using the assets it already had to achieve our own goals of social housing and make sure that it is not regionalized. It can then begin to compete with some of the best ones that they are in existence in the market at the moment. I think you will have seen in East London that company, that social housing institution. They are expected to operate on the same basis and therefore start to increase the stock that we require in the social housing rental market. Our approval, which was given subsequent or ex post facto, was not just open, blanket. It was conditional on certain things being fulfilled and at particular times, one of which was this issue of ensuring that they bring it, they are able to bring it to operational, to be an operational and viable institution, as well as then they find an investor who then releases them from that burden and therefore recoup all of their money that they put in the institution. And I think that was a reasonable consideration.
There's a follow-up question from Mr. Singh.
Sure, just a very short, perhaps not even a question, but a comment. It's obviously of concern to us because I get the impression we're now being both referee and player in this sort of market. And the concern is relative to other state entities where they seem to compete in the open market with other organizations. And I don't have to mention them. Where if they've got links to the state, the government owned 100% shareholding, they seem to think that government has got deep pockets, and whether they then make losses or not, they get bailed out every time. And that is my concern. I understand the reasons why in this particular case the steps were taken that were taken to basically sort of not guarantee but look after a current investment. But I would certainly, my request to the CEO and to NHFC is that we need to make sure, particularly because we need this type of institution or this type of developer, to make sure, do everything in our power to make sure that they actually succeed, that they don't take the mentality that it's actually government-owned and they've got deep pockets.
I think we have come to the end of this debate. Is there anything that would you like to add, CEO?
Yes, Madam Chair. With your permission.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think it will not be
prudent for me not to put it to the committee. Around, I did allude a bit about the experiences when we did retail direct ourselves. And our experience today says that NHFC can do retail, or anyone can do retail, because in a retail space, we're not competing with the bank. That's not the idea. The main idea of retail was to be able to deepen the reach to that segment of the market that may not even be serviced by the bank, especially over a long time. I think the experiences, the credit crunch was very evident. The banks just tightened their lending, and a lot of people could not get loans. We had an avalanche, everyone coming to NHFC looking for a loan. Mortgage originators, developers, they all queued, asking to say, please, can you provide end-user finance for these people? Now, Madam Chair, the demand is on the ground. There's no question about that. People do have needs. And some of them have a certain level of affordability so that they could repay something. But our conclusion is that unless the sources of funding are developmental as well, such people's needs cannot be met. It does not help us, even if we go to the market and raise the money, it does not help us to even use. Right now, we have funded the whole retail operation to the tune of about 250 million. That's what we've committed ourselves on just this retail experiment over 12 months, 250 million. And in that, it will deliver in total 1,000 units. But that's already gone. And if we continued to actually fund it, what will be required of NHFC is 1.3 billion. And the question is, even if that money was available, at what price is it going to be actually lended out at? And I think our conclusion is that because we're not in retail to compete with the banks, we're plugging a gap which will never be addressed. Then you need different sources of funding to support that kind of initiative. And without that, you might as well not to do retail at all. And I think the unfortunate part is those people's needs, housing finance needs, will still not be met. So there is, I think, a consideration that must be made to say some kind of funding needs to come, either be blended as suggested earlier, but it cannot be private market funding that will actually deal with this segment of the market. So I'd just like to table that and just to the committee to say it is a challenge. And based on NHFC's experience, we use our own balances to support the 250 million. And the board has also said that then if we're to continue doing this, then we need to get funding from elsewhere, because we cannot be sustainable in the long term just to do that from money that you will be paying interest over. So that's really what I wanted to actually highlight in mm-hmm. terms of our retail experience. Thank you.
Thank you very much, CEO, and also to the team from the NHSC mm-hmm. and also the department. And I think we have come to the end of our session, but I would like the members just one minute. We are not going to adopt our stress plan. Otherwise, we are not going to be long, because this stress plan was done long time ago. It has been with us, but you don't have to run through it now. It has been with us. Can we adopt? Is there any additions? Get us to them forward, because members are running for the taxes now, for their transport. Honorable.